This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Twitter has removed a tweet by Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, suggesting coronavirus vaccines made in the United States and Britain are, quote, untrustworthy. Twitter, a U.S.-based social networking giant, said the post violated its rules. The supreme leader's tweet said, importing vaccines made in the U.S. or the U.K. is prohibited. They're completely untrustworthy. It's not unlikely they would want to contaminate other nations. A Twitter spokesperson said on Saturday that the tweet, quote, violates specifically our COVID-19 misleading information policy. The U.S. social media company announced a policy in December to crack down on what it described as potentially false or misleading information about COVID-19 vaccinations. And as we have been reporting, U.S. President Donald Trump had his account permanently deleted by Twitter. The company cited concern that Trump would incite further violence. Last week, Trump supporters breached the U.S. Capitol building while lawmakers were counting the Electoral College vote, which would certify Democrat Joe Biden's win in last year's election. Trump's response to Twitter's action was that he'd be building his own platform in the near future and that, quote, we will not be silenced. He's talking of he and his supporters. Trump tweeted 57,000 times on Twitter. His account was just under 12 years old. His most popular tweet was on October 2nd of 2020, announcing that he and his wife Melania had contracted the coronavirus. That tweet reportedly got 1.8 million likes. For more on these stories and others making international news headlines, we invite you to visit our website at voanews.com. This is VOA News. President-elect Joe Biden's victory in November brought with it concerns that he would face Republican opposition in the Senate that could hinder his bold agenda, which addresses climate change, expanding health care, tackling economic inequality, and more. Those worries eased this past week when Democrats swept two Senate special elections in Georgia, giving the party control of Congress and the White House for the first time since 2011. Biden said on Friday, quote, I think this makes my job easier, quite frankly, end quote. But everything he wants isn't a given. The Senate will be split evenly, with Vice President-elect Kamala Harris casting the tie-breaking vote when needed. The Democratic majority in the House is the party's narrowest in decades. That means major legislation probably will not advance without at least some Republican support. Biden will also have to cope with higher expectations after Georgia's results than if he had faced a Republican-controlled Senate. That could lead to battles with progressive Democrats who want to push the new administration further left than it likes. And here are some of the stories making headlines around the world today. A plane thought to have 62 people on board lost contact after taking off from Indonesia's capital, Jakarta, Saturday, and rescuers said suspected debris has been found in the sea off the city. The Boeing 737-500 lost contact shortly after taking off, a search and rescue official told local television. Foreign companies will not be allowed to test COVID-19 vaccines on the Iranian people, President Hassan Rouhani said on Saturday, a day after Iran's supreme leader banned vaccine imports from the United States and Britain. Rouhani said in televised remarks, quote, foreign companies wanted to give us vaccines so they would be tested on the Iranian people, but the health ministry prevented it. He did not name the companies or give further details. Greece's conservative government has submitted a bill to parliament to extend the western limit of its territorial waters in the Ionian Sea to 12 nautical miles following negotiations with its regional neighbors, Italy and Albania. The bill, submitted late on Friday, would extend its western territorial waters from 6 nautical miles currently. It would not affect waters in the Aegean off Greece's southern and eastern coasts, where Athens has been in dispute with its NATO ally Turkey over maritime boundaries. Again, we invite you to visit our website for more stories. That's voanews.com. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, Ashraf Khalil, Washington, D.C. Metro Reporter for the Associated Press, and our moderator is Dan Revive, columnist for Newsday.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues from yet another historic week here in America's capital city, the first full week of a new year. Thousands of protesters who came here from around the country pledging loyalty to Donald Trump, saying they would fight to let him continue as president of the United States, invaded the United States Congress, breaking into the Capitol building with its landmark white dome overhead. In scuffles with police, one of the trespassers, a woman from California, was shot dead. Three other people died in medical emergencies. President Trump, in a video message, said he loves the protesters, but told them to go home. And the next morning, on Thursday, the White House put out a statement that there will be, quote, an orderly transition to a new president, meaning Joe Biden, on January 20th. We'll also analyze the election results in Georgia, a big win for Biden's party, the Democrats, winning control of the United States Senate. And the continuing tragedy of the coronavirus, actually worse than ever. Josh Glancy, you're a British reporter covering America. The last time the Capitol building was invaded was by British troops in the War of 1812. More than 200 years later, we all saw an insurrection, this time by American citizens trying to stop Congress from confirming Joe Biden's victory. Josh, what did you see?
Well, it was in many ways unprecedented and unbelievable scenes that we saw in the Capitol on Wednesday. I think on one level, it has to be viewed as an enormous failure of security. We all knew that this protest was going to happen. Anyone who follows the movement around Trump or the president himself saw the warning signs. They were very public about them. And yet when this group of very agitated protesters arrived at the Capitol building, the defenses were hugely insufficient. There were the Capitol Hill cops, and they were not there in great numbers, and they didn't seem to have any backup. And so on one level, we can see this as an enormous failure of policing and of national security. I mean, the fact is they had to, you know, evacuate the vice president at one point. He's number two in line to the presidency. You know, I mean, it didn't excusable on that level. On another level, obviously, there's a huge amount of recrimination has to go to the president for supporting and inciting these group of people to go and not just protest outside Congress, but invade the inner sanctums. I mean, you saw a guy with his feet up on Nancy Pelosi's office. You saw people waving the broken up plaque of the sign outside that says it's her office. They'd smashed it up and they were waving it in the halls of Congress. You saw a woman shot and killed. And we don't know the exact details of how this happened. An Air Force veteran who was protesting and was shot in the halls of Congress. These are astonishing scenes. I mean, as someone pointed out recently, America spends nigh on $1 trillion a year on defense and yet wasn't able to protect the halls of Congress. You know, that's an astonishing moment in the history of this republic.
It does seem that there will be hearings on just that very issue, the security of Congress. And you're right, more than $500 million in the annual budget of the United States Capitol Police. But what about the passions? I mean, what do we say about tens of thousands of people who really believe that there was cheating in the November election, that Donald Trump is being forced out of office wrongly? Ashraf Khalil, right, you cover this city for the Associated Press. You've reported on tumultuous events, including anti-Trump protests, changing of a city street near the White House. It's now called Black Lives Matter Plaza. This time it was like the pro-Trump side. Tens of thousands of his strongest supporters came to this city. They got a speech by the president. They marched to the Capitol. In everything you've seen, did you suppose that there would be a violent invasion of the Capitol building?
Well, having seen the last two prior pro-Trump protests, there was one in November, there was one in December, you could see an escalation in numbers and in violent tactics. The first one in November, I think, drew around 15,000 people. The one in December drew fewer. attendees, but a much larger contingent of people wearing Proud Boy colors, this sort of almost militia group that's taking the forefront in this movement. And they were very violent and they were looking for a fight. So I was expecting an escalation on those terms. The surprise was, as Josh said, the total failure to protect the building. This is the U.S. Capitol. And basically, they faced almost zero resistance to get to the Capitol grounds. There was a fence around the Capitol grounds, but it was the kind of fencing that you put up temporarily to keep like deer and stuff out of your garden. It was not a fence. It was not the kind of fence that's around Lafayette Park and around the White House. And I think they were just caught flat-footed by the focus of the protesters. This is something me and my colleagues were sort of hashing out in the aftermath, in that this wasn't a protest that sort of like went weird. You know, a lot of us have covered protests where somebody breaks a window and then everything goes mob violence and then sort of the madness of crowds. This was not necessarily organized, but it was very focused. They knew exactly what they wanted to do, and they kind of like probed the different ways to get into the building and to the steps and to pass the police. And it was hugely successful from their perspective.
Let's keep in mind that it started while the United States Congress was performing a vital ceremonial duty. Every 4 years after a presidential election, Congress, you could say, counts the votes. Now, they don't really do the count. The envelopes or certificates are opened from all 50 states and Washington, D.C. The vice president acts as the president of the Senate. And as the senators and House members are sitting together, state by state, the results are read aloud, and normally they're just accepted without any problem. This time it was clear that supporters of President Trump in both the House and the Senate would object, and that process had begun. It's alphabetical. So Alaska was no problem, Alabama no problem. But when they got to Arizona, well, then the House and Senate went into separate sessions to debate, and that's when the violence started. And that's when members of the House of Representatives had to actually get down on the floor and police, plainclothes police, right, holding their guns, pointing at the doors of the House of Representatives chamber to keep the rioters out of the chamber, whereas the protesters or rioters did get into the Senate chamber just after the vice president and 100 senators, all 100, were evacuated. It was a chaotic scene, but I didn't want to lose sight of the business. The business did get done. The Senate and House resumed their work late Wednesday night. They worked until about 4 o'clock in the morning on Thursday. And it is official now that Joe Biden, former vice president, former senator, will be the president, sworn in on January 20th. Kamala Harris, who's been a senator from California, will be the vice president. Josh, you know, in a way, at least America did fulfill its function, or Congress, you know, Congress did step up and do it.
They did, and it's really important that after the awful scenes we saw on Wednesday afternoon and evening, that Congress came back and did their duty and certified the results. And that's what's always been strange about this process that we've had of Trump denying and seeking to overturn the election results, is that it's never ever felt likely that it would happen. There's never been a massive support both in Congress or even beyond it for Trump's attempts. I mean, anyone who really looks carefully at what happened knows that there wasn't mass electoral fraud. But nonetheless, this performance has continued with these protests, with Trump's tweets, with these frivolous lawsuits being launched and then chucked out of court. And it carried on, this process, and it was almost felt as though there wouldn't be any serious repercussions, as though they could have run this election denialism. And there were people in Congress who said, well, they're not going to overturn the election, so why don't I give it a nod and a wink? You know, we're just raising questions, that sort of thing. Well, what we saw this week is that actions have consequences, and those consequences came to the very heart of American power, to the very heart of Washington, D.C., and we'll be living with them for a very long time.
Yeah, we'll have to see what the consequences are, or whether everyone in U.S. politics just wants to turn the page on January 20th. So for the record, the Senate and the House did debate some objections about some of the states, but a typical vote was on the Arizona objection. The United States Senate voted 92-7 to reject the objection. In other words, to accept the Electoral College numbers. And so it was overwhelming. But if one thinks about it, in the House of Representatives, with more than 100 of the 435 members wanting to reject the official count, That meant that more than half of the Republicans in the House were taking Trump's side. Now, this put Vice President Mike Pence in a situation of great pressure. President Trump publicly said that his Vice President Mike Pence, as ceremonial president of the Senate, should reject the numbers, send it back to the states, make them come up with new results so Trump could continue as president. Ashraf, the pressure was amazing, but Pence decided to just follow the script and act dignified.
Yeah, Pence was subject to intense speculation for the last week, really, and a lot on Wednesday. I spoke to one protester just before, just as they were getting started with the roll call of the states that only got to Arizona, as you said. And he was a minister, the head of a Christian NGO in Philadelphia. And he was putting a lot of stock in Pence. I was like, what do you think Pence is going to do? He's like, I don't know. He must be under a lot of pressure. And I said, it's okay. As a fellow man of faith, if Pence looks at the law and looks at his conscience and comes to the honest conclusion that I cannot interfere in this way, will that satisfy you? And he thought about it for a while. He's like, I think I could probably be at peace with that. And that's kind of the question, is who among the supporters now, who is Pence going to become a villain? The way that Bill Barr, the former attorney general, like immediately became a villain with this crowd? Or is the fact that he, as the man who kind of lent sort of moral armor in a way to many of President Trump's excesses in the minds of the Christian right, is he choosing not to fight this fight going to sway some of them with his credibility? Because we've seen when Bill Barr came out and said he couldn't find electoral fraud, the attorney general, immediately I was talking to protesters that were like, oh, he's a sellout. Oh, I had a woman tell me, oh, everyone knows he's good friends with Joe Biden. So is everyone going to turn on Pence now, or is his personal credibility going to sort of add a little bit of legitimacy or to take away some of the sting for these people?
As we're hearing, there are still strong divisions when it comes to politics in America. There were election results from Georgia that really will make a difference in Congress. We'll talk about that and a lot more after this short break.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times. Ashraf Khalil, Washington, D.C. Metro reporter for the Associated Press. And our moderator, Dan Raviv, columnist for Newsday.
Just before our break, Ashraf was saying that Vice President Mike Pence had been under pressure, and what the pro-Trump protesters, some of whom, thousands of whom apparently broke into the Capitol building, what they thought about Pence as though the vice president would save their hero, President Trump, what they expected. In the end, it was Pence at 3:45 in the morning on Thursday who officially announced that Trump and Pence had lost and that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris had won the election. And Biden and Harris will be sworn in right there, just outside the Capitol building on January 20th. Josh Glancy, what's your take on the drama around Mike Pence?
Well, I think Mike Pence has shown himself to be someone who believes in the system and isn't willing to bend entirely under the will of his boss, Donald Trump. There have been times over the last few years when he's been somewhat quiet and reserved and withdrawn as a figure and has signaled his frustrations with the president very subtly. But when called upon this week to support the American system and the transfer of power and the Constitution and his duty as vice president, he did so. Behind the scenes, we know from reporting that Vice President Pence was absolutely furious with Donald Trump's failure to respond to the violence we saw in the Capitol. And it's been reported that it was ultimately the vice president and not Donald Trump who called in the National Guard and called in reinforcements to end the scenes in Congress. So you don't necessarily have to like Mike Pence or admire Mike Pence, but he has done his constitutional duty as vice president this week. And that's very important, because had he not, then we'd be in an even messier situation.
As for President Trump, he was banned at least for 12 hours from Twitter. That company, Twitter, decided no longer to put out the messages from President Donald Trump. No videos from Trump. Facebook made the same decision, meaning that Trump was also banned from YouTube. Those corporations decided that some of what Trump has been saying has been dangerous, has been mistaken, has been false, has been inciting trouble in the United States. Of course, this will cause more trouble in the sense of political conservatives thinking that Twitter, Facebook, and other social networking companies should not have this power to censor and decide who gets to be there. Anyway, there was a Twitter statement from a White House official on Thursday morning. It says Donald J. Trump declares, quote, "Even though I totally disagree with the outcome of the election and the facts bear me out, nevertheless, there will be an orderly transition on January 20th. President Trump in this statement says it's just the beginning of, quote, our fight to make America great again. But he is confirming, apparently, he'll be leaving on January 20th. And there is a big change. It's not only a Democrat. Joe Biden will be the president. Democrats still control the House of Representatives, though they did lose seats in November. But the United States Senate was just on the razor's edge. Would the Republicans hold it? Well, they won't. We got the results from Georgia, special runoff elections. Two Republicans who held their Senate seats, Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, they lost. They're gone. And the winners are the Reverend Raphael Warnock and documentary filmmaker John Ossoff. In America's Deep South, a state, Georgia, thought of as highly conservative, by a small margin, gave both victories to liberal candidates, a black church preacher, Warnock, and a Jewish journalist, notably only 33 years old, John Ossoff. So Josh Glancy, again, Georgia has surprised America. Do you think that was a response in part to Trump and his big outdoor rally on the eve of the Georgia election?
Well, I think it would be too simplistic to draw a direct line and say that, you know, Trump lost the Republicans Georgia. There's a lot of factors at play there. The Republicans ran two not hugely impressive candidates, both who had somewhat scandalous associations with allegations of insider trading around the pandemic, Loeffler and Perdue. The Democrats have run a really impressive get out the vote operation in Georgia for many years now, or several years, I should say, spearheaded by Stacey Abrams, a local activist and politician. So there are a lot of factors at play in Georgia. But nonetheless, you would have to look at the way Trump has gone to war with the Georgia Republican Party, including Governor Brian Kemp, the way allies of his have undermined the process and the election in Georgia, the call that was leaked that Trump had with a Georgia election official asking him to overturn the election. None of that is likely to have helped, because the reason Republicans lost in Georgia in November was because they alienated a lot of moderate suburban voters who previously were probably quite solidly Republican, but don't like the direction the party's taken under Trump and delivered the state to Joe Biden in November and appear to have delivered now the state to the Democrats again. And now they've given them control of the Senate, which changes the landscape of American politics for the next 2 years. So there's a lot of frustration in Republican ranks at the way that Trump and his allies muddied the waters and upset the apple cart, shall we say, down in Georgia with their allegations against the election. And it certainly hasn't helped them and has had electoral consequences.
Well, there are many signs that the Republican Party has internal divisions, not only in Georgia, but nationwide. And if the United States Senate now will be 50 Democrats and 50 Republicans, Ashraf Khalil, it falls to you to explain to our global VOA News audience, 50-50, how is that a majority for the Democrats?
Well, when it's a 50-50 tie, the deciding vote is cast by the sitting vice president. So 50-50 becomes a majority. And so that makes Kamala Harris the deciding, essentially, tiebreaker going forward in these things. So the way that the American government is structured, that affects the checks and balances between the executive branch and the legislative branch. It certainly affects, especially on contentious issues that are likely to go down on a hard partisan split. So that comes up with a bunch of different issues, not only healthcare reform, either bringing back some form of Obamacare or the subject of whether Washington, D.C. should become a state. I can almost guarantee that's going to come up during the next 2-year window. So if Republicans had retained control of the Senate has a lot of powers that are unique just to the Senate. And a Republican-led Senate could have greatly delayed or even derailed many, many, many of the major initiatives that a new Biden administration would have wanted to put in. So this really does clear the runway for sweeping changes.
And very soon, the United States Senate will be called upon to confirm or reject dozens of important nominations by Joe Biden as he becomes president, who will be his attorney general, who will fill other cabinet positions. We heard that Merrick Garland, who had been Barack Obama's nominee for the Supreme Court, but the Republican-led Senate refused to even consider Garland back in 2016, that now he will be Biden's nominee to be attorney general. And because of what happened in the Georgia election, well, that means that Biden will probably get his entire cabinet confirmed. We have to talk about COVID-19, worse than ever. You know, last year, on average, about 1,000 Americans died every day since the pandemic began in March of last year. Lately, it's been well over 3,000 deaths a day. Hospitals in major cities, notably Los Angeles, are absolutely paralyzed with every bed being used to treat people. And in L.A., ambulance drivers were ordered to assess, does this person have a chance to survive, let's say, after a heart attack? And if they seem to have little chance, don't bring them to the hospital. Josh, this is just a shock for the American healthcare system, which has proven itself to be fragmented. Even the vaccines aren't being delivered in a quick and efficient way into the arms of America.
Yes, unfortunately, we're seeing the continuation of what has been a really systemic failure. And it's not just America that's faced this. A lot of Western countries, including my own country, Britain, have struggled deeply with the overall response to COVID-19, whether it's healthcare or government oversight or the vaccine rollout. As you point out, the vaccine rollout in America, after much celebration about the efficacy of the vaccines that have been developed by Pfizer and Moderna and others, they don't seem to be being rolled out very efficiently. There's a lot of reports of vaccines being left on the shelf and unused. Plans to get 20 million people vaccinated by the end of the year of 2020. America didn't come close to hitting that target. They're at about 4 or 5 million. And so the timeline, as it has been throughout, keeps getting pushed back. Well, we hope that we might have some normality by spring. Well, that doesn't look likely now, with just a tiny percentage of the American population currently vaccinated. In many ways, people look to 2021 as being better than last year. We sort of wrote off 2020 as a bit of a disaster. I think we now have to acknowledge that this is going to probably take up most of this year, and it's going to be a long, grim haul, and we're going to be counting death numbers and triaging at hospitals for many months to come.
Ashraf, what's your take on the American system, where the 50 states in Washington, D.C. have their own plans, their own schedules for when people can get the vaccine, instead of having a national system for delivering the vaccination?
Well, this is one of the quirks of the American response to the virus. America, as a country that was founded by revolutionaries trying to escape an overarching monarchy with absolute power, authority is devolved down to the states. The states, the individual states, have a lot of autonomy and are very reluctant to give up any of that autonomy. So as a result, especially with the COVID reaction, in the absence of an overarching strategy from the White House, and that hasn't really been present, you've had states competing for ventilators last year. You've had different states have formed up as like almost like different pods to work together in the absence of federal direction. You actually had a kind of a nice story here in Washington, D.C., where Washington, D.C. was kind of being shortchanged on the number of vaccines it was receiving. And they were complaining about it, saying that the first shipment won't even cover 1/10 of first responders. And so the neighboring states of Maryland and Virginia each donated 8,000 doses to Washington, D.C. And so states can make of that what they want. In some cases, there's going to be competition and lack of coordination. And in some cases, you'll actually see states acting like little family units. So it all comes down to human nature in the absence of proper guidance from the top.
Despite all these challenges, Happy New Year to you, to our listeners. That's all the time we have. Our thanks, of course, to our panelists, Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the British newspaper, The Sunday Times, and Ashraf Khalil, Washington, D.C. Metro reporter for the Associated Press. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Dan Ravi.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn and Alice Bryant. Later, Anna Mateo answers a question from an English learner. Can a sentence begin with a conjunction? We close our show with an American story. This week, it is The Purloined Letter by Edgar Allan Poe. But first,
China is reportedly building a wall along its border with Vietnam to stop people and goods from leaving China. Plans to construct a 2-meter-high border wall in southwestern China were reported in October by Radio Free Asia. The report was based on information collected from social media and comments from individuals living in areas near the construction. Experts say the wall appears to be an attempt by China's government to keep its citizens at home and reduce smuggling across both sides of the border. The plan demonstrates Chinese concerns about migrants going to Vietnam after China's unemployment rate grew to 6% in the first half of 2020. Economic difficulties caused by COVID-19 restrictions worldwide have weakened demand for manufactured exports from China. This has led to reductions in factory-related jobs. The Hong Kong-based workers' rights group China Labor Bulletin says Chinese workers are protesting pay cuts as their companies reduce production or go out of business. Alexander Vuving is a professor at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies in Hawaii. He told VOA the most likely reason China would build such a border wall is to keep control. The wall would be a perfect tool to control the flows of people, of things, of everything across the border, Vuving said. The Chinese government does not like its citizens leaving the country without approval, especially if they take money out. Video posted to Chinese social media in late October appeared to show about 1,000 Chinese migrant workers gathering in southwestern China near a border crossing with Vietnam. In Vietnam, about 900,000 people were unemployed as of June 30th, and another 18 million were underemployed, the country's General Statistics Office reported. Even with those numbers, factories supported by Chinese investors welcome workers from China because of their experience with companies at home. Investors picked Vietnam to avoid paying tariffs on goods exported directly from China to the United States, said Nguyen Tong Trung. He is the director of the Center for International Studies at the University of Social Sciences and Humanities in Ho Chi Minh City. Nguyen said the tariffs resulted from a three-year-old China-U.S. trade dispute. The trade war between China and the U.S., that's the reason why so many Chinese companies come to Vietnam to avoid Chinese tariffs. And that's the reason they need Chinese labor, he said. Professor Vu Ving said a wall along any border would have the added effects of blocking escapes by Chinese political dissidents and stopping casino visitors from taking money out of the country. China is also building a fence along parts of its border with Myanmar, a popular spot for Chinese casino visitors. China is Vietnam's biggest trading partner, with about $100 billion in business during the first 10 months of 2020. Most of that amount represents exports to Vietnam. Carl Thayer is a professor of Southeast Asian Studies at Australia's University of New South Wales. He told VOA that a border wall could help both countries. Vietnam has as much interest as China in closing cross-border smuggling, particularly since it has such a massive trade deficit with China, Thayer said. I'm Brian Lin.
Award-winning American comedian and actor Dave Chappelle is set to buy a former fire station near his Ohio hometown. He plans to turn it into a space where other comedians can perform live shows. The Miami Township Fire Station will be sold to Chappelle's company. It is situated in the town of Yellow Springs, Ohio, where Chappelle lives. His future comedy club will seat 140 people, the Dayton Daily News reported. The closing date for the sale is set for early 2021, said Lisa Abel. She is president of the Yellow Springs Development Corporation, which is carrying out the sale. Corey Van Ostel is a board member of the corporation. She said the Yellow Springs company wanted a buyer who would breathe life into the station. We think this will bring a new class of jobs to town, Van Ostel said. We also considered that Chappelle is a minority business owner, she added. Chappelle has a history of employing minorities, she said, and is firm about supporting the voices of people of color. Chappelle's ties to Ohio go back to his father. William David Chappelle studied at Antioch College, a private liberal arts school in Yellow Springs. Later, he became a professor there. Chappelle lives with his family outside the village and also owns homes in the nearby town of Xenia. In June, Chappelle held a private outdoor social commentary performance on his property in Yellow Springs. Attendees were socially distant and wore facial coverings. The event was filmed and later released on the video streaming service Netflix under the name 846. The number refers to the police killing last year of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota. A police officer named Derek Chauvin kneeled on Floyd's neck for almost 9 minutes straight, killing the man. The event led to months of demonstrations against police abuse of black and brown people. Chappelle is best known for his television comedy program, Chappelle's Show. He is also a highly respected live comedy performer. His shows often examine race and gender issues with humor. In 2019, he received the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. The award goes to people who have influenced American society in ways similar to Mark Twain, the 19th century American writer. I'm Alice Bryant.
This week on Ask a Teacher, we answer a question from Yi Jun. Yi Jun asks if it is correct to begin a sentence with conjunctions such as and, but, and or. Their grammar book, this person adds, says no. It is completely acceptable to begin a sentence with the words and, but, and or. Conjunction words like these join together sentences, clauses, or phrases. Sometimes starting a sentence with a conjunction makes your writing sound better. It can keep your thoughts clearly separate. And it can add importance to a thought, like in this example. Not only is Stella my sister, she also is my best friend. And she is a great business partner, too. Other times, it might be better to use a different word, such as, however. The word, however, sounds a bit more formal and serious than but. The right word choice depends on the kind of writing you are doing. Let's look at another example. This one is from a recent Words and Their Stories article on the Learning English website. Listen for the two sentences that begin with a conjunction. To make it on Broadway, you have to be very good, but you also have to be tough. Actors usually have many doors closed in their faces before other doors, hopefully, open. But even if you are hardworking and gifted, you may also need something else to succeed on Broadway. Luck. Yi Chun's question is not surprising. Many people are taught to avoid using conjunction words at the start of sentences. In fact, experts at Merriam-Webster.com write, "Everybody agrees that it's all right to begin a sentence with and." And nearly everybody admits to having been taught at some past time that the practice was wrong. And that is Ask a Teacher. What question do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. I'm Ana Mateo.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int, or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Our story today is called The Purloined Letter. It was written by Edgar Allan Poe. Poe is generally known for his horror stories. This is the third of three stories he wrote about Auguste Dupin and how he solves crimes. The story is about a stolen letter. It first appeared in 1844 in a yearly magazine. It was reprinted in many publications, newspapers, and books. This is one of Poe's stories that influenced the development of the modern detective story.
One evening in Paris, during the autumn of 1845, I went to visit a friend, Auguste Dupin. We were smoking our pipes and talking when the door of his apartment opened. Mr. Germain, the head of the Paris police force, came into the room. "I came to ask your advice," Germain said to my friend Dupin. "I'm trying to solve a very important case. It is also a very simple case, so I really need your help. But I thought you would like to hear about it, because it is so strange. My men and I have worked on this case for 3 months, as Germain said. It is a very simple case of robbery, but we still cannot solve it." Dupin took the pipe out of his mouth. "Perhaps the mystery is too simple," he said. Germain began to laugh. "Too simple," he said. "Who ever heard of such a thing?" I looked at Germain. "Why don't you tell us the problem?" I said. Germain stopped laughing and sat down. "All right," he said, "but you must never tell anyone I told you this. The wife of a very important person needs help. I cannot tell you her name, because her husband is a powerful man in the French government. Let us just call her Madame X. 3 months ago, someone stole a letter from Madame X. She is offering a large amount of money to anyone who can return the letter to her. We know that her husband's political enemy, Mr. Darcy, stole the letter. We also know it is somewhere in his apartment. Darcy plans to use the letter to embarrass Madame X's husband and destroy his political power. As you know, I have keys which can open any lock in Paris. For the last 3 months, my man and I have spent every evening looking for the letter in his apartment. But we cannot find it. Dupin stopped smoking. Tell me how you looked for it, he said. Jamont moved forward in his chair. We took our time, he said. First, we examined the furniture in every room. We opened all the drawers. We looked under the rugs. We searched behind all the paintings on the walls. We opened every book. We removed the boards of the floor. We even took the tops off the tables to see if he had hidden the letter in the table legs. But we cannot find it. What do you advise me to do? Dupin puffed on his pipe. What does the letter look like? He asked. It is in a white envelope with a red stamp, Germain said. The address is written in large black letters. Dupin puffed on his pipe again. I advise you to go back and search the apartment again, he said. About 1 month later, Germain came back to see us. I followed your advice, he said, but I still have not found the letter. Dupin smiled. I knew you would not find it, he said. Jamont became very red in the face. Then why did you make me search the apartment again? He shouted. My dear Jamont, Dupin said, let me tell you a little story. Do you remember the famous Dr. Louis Abernathy? No, Jamont shouted. Get to the point, Dupin. Of course, Dupin said. Once a rich old man met Abernathy at a party. The old man was not feeling very well. He decided he would get a medical opinion from the doctor without paying for it. So he described his problems to Abernathy. Now, doctor, the old man said, suppose you had a patient like that. What would you tell him to take? Oh, that is quite simple, said Abernathy. I would tell him to take my advice. Germont looked embarrassed. Look here, Dupin, I'm perfectly willing to pay for advice. Dupin smiled at Germont. How much money did you say the reward was? He asked. Germont sighed. I do not want to tell you the exact amount, but I would give 50,000 francs to the person who helps me find that letter. In that case, Dupin said, take out your checkbook and write me a check for 50,000 francs. When you have signed the check, I will give you the letter. Germain looked at Dupin with his mouth open. His eyes seemed to jump out of his head. Then he took out his checkbook and pen and wrote a check for 50,000 francs. He gave it to Dupin. My friend examined the check carefully and put it in his pocket. Then he unlocked a drawer of his desk, took out the letter, and gave it to Germain. The policeman's hands shook as he opened the letter. He read it quickly. Then he put it in his pocket and ran out of the room without saying a word. Dupin, I said, as I turned to my friend, how did you solve the mystery? It was simple, my friend, he said. Germain and his policeman could not find the letter, because they did not try to understand the mind of the man who stole it. Instead, they looked for the letter where they would have hidden it. Mr. Darcy is not a policeman. He is, however, very intelligent. He knew the police would search his apartment. He also knew how police think, so he did not hide the letter where he knew they would look for it. Do you remember how Germont laughed when I said the mystery was difficult for him to solve because it was so simple? Dupin filled his pipe with tobacco and lit it. Well, the more I thought about it, the more I realized the police could not find the letter, because Darcy had not hidden it at all. So, I went to visit Darcy in his apartment. I took a pair of dark green eyeglasses with me. I explained to him that I was having trouble with my eyes and needed to wear the dark glasses at all times. He believed me. The glasses permitted me to look around the apartment while I seemed only to be talking to him. I paid special attention to a large desk where there were a lot of papers and books. However, I saw nothing suspicious there. After a few minutes, however, I noticed a small shelf over the fireplace. A few postcards and a letter were lying on the shelf. The letter looked very old and dirty. As soon as I saw this letter, I decided it must be the one I was looking for. It must be, even though it was completely different from the one Germont had described. This letter had a large green stamp on it. The address was written in small letters, in blue ink. I memorized every detail of the letter while I talked to Darcy. Then, when he was not looking, I dropped one of my gloves on the floor under my chair. The next morning, I stopped at his apartment to look for my glove. While we were talking, we heard people shouting in the street. Darcy went to the window and looked out. Quickly, I stepped to the shelf and put the letter in my pocket. Then, I replaced it with a letter that looked exactly like it, which I had taken with me. I had made it the night before. The trouble in the street was caused by a man who had almost been run over by a horse and carriage. He was not hurt, and soon the crowd of people went away. When it was over, Darcy came away from the window. I said goodbye and left. The man who almost had an accident was one of my servants. I had paid him to create the incident. Dupin stopped talking to light his pipe. I did not understand. "But Dupin," I said, "why did you go to the trouble of replacing the letter? Why not just take it and leave?" Dupin smiled. "Darcy is a dangerous man," he said, "and he has many loyal servants. If I had taken the letter, I might never have left his apartment alive."
The Purloined Letter was written by Edgar Allan Poe and adapted by Donna DeSanctis. The storyteller was Shep O'Neill. The producer was Lawan Davis.
That's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.